There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with your coolest conversations podcast in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and remember to follow and subscribe, rate and review. Joining me today is Tegan Quinn, one of the Canadian Quinn twins, the other being Sarah. And they've been making music together at least since 1998. That includes 9 albums. The latest came out this past September and it's called Hey, I'm Just Like You, and features our coolest song of the week, I'll Be Back Someday. Let's hear some of that, and then I'll be back with Tegan for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Sit and watch my TV set. What is on will make it better. What's up? Go to dial, but then I stop. Why don't you call? To the end, my friend. Oh, what a lie. Oh, what a lie. If I could pretend, if I could lie, if I could lie. But I can't say, no, I can't stay.
Manfred here, and it's time for your coolest conversations. Joining me today is Tegan Quinn, one half of Tegan and Sarah, whose 9th album, Hey, I'm Just Like You, came out a couple of days after their first book was published, titled High School, a memoir of high school. Thanks for speaking with me today, Tegan.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Yeah, well, the album is re-recordings of unreleased demo songs that you guys had worked on as teenagers. The book is a memoir of both your childhoods and adolescence growing up in Calgary, there in Alberta, back in the 90s. And I think it also involves your musical beginnings. Which idea came first, the idea of re-recording the old demos or the idea to do a memoir?
The memoir came first. You know, we had finished a really long record cycle and we were off the road and we were, you know, itching to be creative, but, you know, not necessarily make a record right away, because what happens when you make a record is then you have to put it out and go on tour, and I didn't want to do that. So we started talking about other creative things we could do, and we came up with the concept for the book and spent a few months writing the proposal, and then we sold it and set out to actually finish writing it. And at that point, I made a few trips back home to Calgary, where we grew up, and a lot of our friends who were still close to from high school, they gave me this just mountain of photos and videos and journals and one demo tape of songs that we'd written in high school. And I sort of became obsessed with finding, there was two that we recorded in high school. I became obsessed with finding the second one. And it took months, but when I got the two demo tapes digitized and started listening to them, I was really struck by how good the songs were. You know, I'd sort of done what most people do and imagined that, oh, they were our first songs, they're probably terrible. You know, it did cringe because we were so young in the recordings and we're very silly and the recordings are rough. But yeah, I was just really struck by the songs. So when we finished writing the book, we had talked about maybe for the audiobook putting some of the demos in there. But I, at that point, had become really obsessed with this idea of recording them and making a record that would come out the same time as the book. And thankfully, Sarah agreed.
So the memoir has been out a couple of months. The album as well. I think they both came out in September. Have you heard from any young people who are facing or undergoing the same types of hurdles that you dealt with?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, I feel like that's the best part of our job is that we get to sort of work through our issues and emotions and experiences publicly. And there's this like amazing support group around the world. That's sort of what it feels like sometimes to be in our band. You know, we're so vulnerable and open and we share a lot about ourselves. And in return, I feel like the people who listen to our music do the same. And it really does feel like the book is resonating with people. You know, it's a book I think that anyone can relate to. You know, I think we all have to go through adolescence. We all kind of experience it as being kind of awful. And so, yeah, it's been really cool. It's been cool to see the different kinds of people that are resonating resonating with it and to hear other people's experiences. There's this whole trend where people are sending us their photos of themselves in high school. It's hilarious. It's really awesome. It's beautiful. I mean, it's hilarious in the sense that we were all the same, you know, we all went through that awkward stage and it's this really amazing way to connect with people. So,
well, and you two were fortunate because you had one another to confide in, assuming for a moment that you didn't have a twin. That would have made things a lot more difficult, or not?
Well, you know, to be honest, I think, you know, we didn't do a lot of confiding. I think there was great comfort that came from having the other, but yeah. We didn't share a lot about ourselves with each other. I think probably there was a self-consciousness because we both realized, especially as we became teenagers, that we were both queer or gay or, you know, starting to struggle with that. And I think we were awkward about it, which I think really blows people's minds because I think people just assume, oh, well, you were twins. You were probably best friends and told each other everything. And we really didn't. But I won't say that we didn't find comfort in each other, because I really did. I think that Sarah and I always thought it was cool that I had a twin, because I think we stood out, and I don't know, just we were set apart, you know, especially with music. Like, once we started playing music, I don't even know if we were that good, but people were like, wow, there's two of them and they're singing together. Wow. And so there was great comfort from that, I think. But, you know, I think we struggled like anybody else. I think there was in writing the book, I was struck by how much of Sarah's interior life growing up, I didn't know about. You know, there were a lot of emotional experiences that she went through that I didn't know about. You know, I think if anything, it sort of just proves that you can know somebody really well, and then there's just a whole other part of them that you don't have access to. So,
well, I've read that you both started writing songs, playing guitar when you were 15. Is that right?
Yeah, we figured out that it was, I think, in November of 1996, we were in our first semester of grade 10, our first semester of high school, and we found a guitar in my stepdad's stuff, and we snuck it out and started messing around with it. You know, we were like most kids in the 90s, you know, obsessed with grunge music, obsessed with Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and Hole, and we started writing songs secretly in our bedrooms and recording them, and then my parents caught us, and they made us do some guitar lessons, which we hated. We both had grown up playing piano and taking lessons, and we were like, we don't want to take guitar lessons. But once they started hearing the songs we were writing, I think they got really into it. My mom bought us a electric guitar, you know, the following semester, and we started a band and forced our friends to listen to us play all the time. I think everyone around us that was an adult realized really quickly that we'd found something we were really interested in, and even though it wasn't academic, that it was kind of helping us to stay between the lines. You know, we'd been experimenting with drugs and sneaking out, and we were constantly in trouble and fighting, and we were pretty estranged from one another at the beginning of grade 10. And I think music was the suture that started to kind of hold us together. And I think a lot of grown-ups and adults in our lives started to support it because they just saw it as perhaps a way out of the mess we'd gotten ourselves into. And
you mentioned that the guitar, that was your stepfather's guitar that you had snuck out.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of music in your household growing up then?
There was a lot of music being played, like on the stereo. Yeah. Like, my stepdad was absolutely obsessed with Bruce Springsteen. We had gigantic framed posters of Bruce all over the house. You know, he was really obsessed with U2. My stepdad and my mom's first big date was that Bruce bought them tickets to fly to Vancouver to see U2. But they also went and saw Bruce Springsteen a number of times. Our first really big concert was Bruce Springsteen when we were 11. And I think, like, our stepdad really taught us how to be music fans. But music was definitely a big part of our household, but nobody played music. Sarah and I played piano, but, like, my stepdad didn't. I don't know why he had the guitar. He said he bought it when he was a teenager, maybe 19. Or 20 years old, and he'd been carrying it around with him. You know, the year that we found it, we were 15 and obviously really obsessed with the idea of starting a band. And I think Bruce loved that. I think he was really excited when we found the guitar because he was so obsessed with music. I think the thought that his kids were going to be musicians. I mean, to this day, I feel like my stepdad is our biggest fan.
Oh, that's great. So our coolest song in the world this week is I'll Be Back Someday. Now, when exactly does that song date from?
So we figure that we wrote that song at the beginning of grade 11. So we would have been 16 years old. And so that would have been, you know, late 1996. We'd just been gifted a electric guitar, a Fender Squire, from my mom for our 16th birthday. And we went through this whole phase where we just wrote really fast kind of punk pop songs. We were obsessed with Green Day and Rancid. And I think we just really wanted to be in a punk band, but we didn't want anyone to join our band. So we started a band. It was called Plunk, which was punk, but with an L, because we were light punk. And we recorded a series of songs that were all super fast and really kind of weird. And one of them was called Johnny, My Friend. and the other was called Gregory. And I found those songs when we were writing the book, and I stitched them together, and that created I'll Be Back Someday.
Okay. How hard was it to get back into your adolescent head to do this song? Or when you hear that, I mean, you're applying yourself from this, you know, older perspective, or do you remember the initial sort of charge that was going on when you were writing those separate songs?
It's a great question. You know, I think people have been, there's like two things people always say to us. They're like, I mean, you guys did a lot of drugs in high school. How did you actually remember any of this and write this memoir? Great question. And also, like, yeah, how did you get into those characters? Like, how did you get back into your adolescent voice? Because I think we do a great job in the book of finding our adolescent voice. And the answer to both those questions is the same. We're really lucky because we kept a lot of journals, a lot of notes. Our friends kept, like I said, like, they came to us with this mountain of stuff. And we had over 20 hours of video footage from that time. And of course, the demo tape. Sarah had all her journals that she'd written, all of our lyrics. And we were very meticulous. Like, Sarah kept notes about who sang which line in the journals. And so we had a lot of stuff to pull from. Thankfully, I did not have to rely entirely on my memory. I did a lot of writing before I had the stuff. And then I would, like, for example, I connected with a woman I hadn't seen in 20 years who we were close friends in high school. And she showed up to this dinner with 20 or 30 notes that I had written to her in high school and a bunch that Sarah had written as well. And it really pieced together the whole story, especially grade 10. It really pieced together because I wrote in this way to her that was very like, today in school, like, we did this, and then after school we went here, and then I came home and I wrote this song. I mean, it's like as if I went in a time machine back to that time and told myself, like, I'm going to need an extremely detail-oriented, like, look at what I was doing in high school because I'm going to write a memoir in 20 years. So, like, it was crazy. It was really, really amazing. So I think, like, it was really important to Sarah and I that the book feel really truthful and honest because we are friends with a lot of people we went to school with, and I really wanted to get it right. I also was very cognizant of not sharing other people's story, you know, really trying to keep the story about me and not reveal too much detail about, you know, people that don't need their details shared.
Well, you've worked with lots of other producers over the years, but I want to know what brought you to Alex Hope, and why was she the one to work on these old recordings with, these old song ideas with?
You know, initially we'd sort of floated the idea of producing the record ourselves. Sarah had co-produced a lot of our biggest records, like So Jealous and The Con and Sainthood, but we were hesitant to take on, you know, doing the production ourselves, but we definitely wanted it to feel like an homage to our younger selves and still feel modern. And we sort of got this idea in our head that we wanted to find someone who was young to make the record with us, somebody who remembered their youth and potentially would bring a youthfulness to the project. And we'd never worked with a female producer before. And so we were basically like, let's try to find someone young and let's try to find a girl. And Alex's name was the first that our A&R sent to us. And we went and met her. She's 25 years old. She had this like amazing studio in her house. And we went into the studio and we started chatting with her. And at one point Sarah said, you know, you've never made a full record. You know, she's working with some of the biggest songwriters in the world, but we were like, you never worked with, you know, on a full record. Do you feel confident that you could make our record? And she was like, yeah. And I just loved her confidence. I loved how nonchalant she was. She confessed to us later that she was really nervous and that her manager had told her, like, be really confident. But at one point, Sarah asked her, you know, you've got every instrument in this room. Which instruments do you play? And, like, what's your strongest instrument? And she said, I play every instrument. And guitar is my strongest instrument. And I loved that answer. I loved that she was so confident. And she was great. She was such a delight to be in the studio with. She had this really awesome confidence, but she was also very compassionate and empathetic. And she really helped us stay, I think she helped us stay on track, but also we really didn't want to change too much of the music. Like, we obviously wanted to modernize it and we needed to fill in some gaps. Like, some of the recordings were so rough, it was hard to hear what we were singing. And there were some lyrics that needed to be rewritten. And I think she allowed us a little room to play with that, but she also kept us on track. Like, you know, she was really great at kind of keeping a youthfulness and vulnerability in the lyrics we did rewrite. And yeah, she was fantastic. I'm really excited to see what she does next. She actually produced most of the new Alanis Morissette record that's coming out as well. Imagine at 25 years old.
I know. Well, you know, these kids today,
so cool.
Everything moves quicker.
So cool.
Yeah.
No kidding.
You know, they use these crazy smartphones. Have you seen that? It's everywhere.
Yeah, smartphones.
Anyway, before I digress about the advantages of my flip phone, I'll very tactile, you know. The other tune off the album I want to talk about is, I know I'm not the only one, but before I get to that, you guys have had a long career, lots of records, toured, done all sorts of fun, cool things. But while I've got you here, there are two other things I want to ask you about.
Sure.
First, the White Stripes covered You're Walking with a Ghost. They did it in 2005. The original's off of So Jealous the prior year. Were you surprised that they covered it?
Yeah, we just heard rumors. So there had been sort of, I mean, obviously remembering the time frame, we didn't have social media in the way that we do now. So
right.
We heard rumors literally through people like, oh, apparently White Stripes are playing Walking with a Ghost live. And we were like, no, that can't possibly be true. Like, you know, they were massive. And we were like this young band who was out playing colleges. You know, we were doing well on alternative radio. The song had been creeping up the charts and eventually did break the top 10, which was really cool. But at that point, you know, we had been out touring the record for quite a while. And so we were very excited by the rumors, but also very realistic. And we were like, it's probably just a rumor. And then someone got a recording of it and sent it to us. And so anyway, we eventually heard directly from the White Stripes that they were going to record a version of it and they were going to put it out on a record they were going to put out. And we were basically like beside ourselves. We couldn't believe it. And Meg came to a show we played in Detroit and she literally brought like a little portable CD player with her and played us the song backstage. And I mean, our minds were blown. You can't even fathom like how cool we thought this was. And then we went bowling with her. She's an incredible bowler, by the way.
Well, wait a minute. Yeah, did you play at the Magic? What's a place called the Magic Stick? Because I had bowling alleys down the bowling alley down below.
Classic. And it was wild afterwards. You know, it was a late show. And then we went over there and yeah, Meg was amazing. I think she was like smoking a cigarette and drinking like a whiskey or something and throwing up in Canada. We 5-pin bowl, which is like this tiny ball that fits in your hand. And then it was our first time 10-pin bowling and we were terrible, but she was incredible. And, you know, it was amazing. It was an incredible boost for us, you know, especially during those days where, again, you know, social media was non-existent. So to have this amazing band who was so credible and, you know, anyway, to have them out doing stuff, it was really incredible. It was a real boost for our band. And, you know, to this day, it's still one of the coolest things that's ever happened to us, for sure.
Well, the other digression I want to ask you about, Everything Is Awesome. So you worked with Mark Mothersbaugh and the Comedy Guys, the Lonely Island Guys. How did that come about?
It's another kind of weird thing where it's like, you know, as artists, you get hit up. You know, we don't get hit up that much, but, you know, we get hit up a bunch, you know, maybe a dozen times a year to like, hey, this artist wants to write, you know, or, you know, there's a commercial that needs a demo. Are you interested? Or this soundtrack is looking for music. And this was one of those things. I was like, hey, there's a movie. It's going to be about Lego. And I was like, oh, and then it was like, you know, a further email, like, hey, there's this cool song. And, you know, our management were like, it actually kind of sounds like you guys. And Mark Mothersbaugh is going to produce it. And Lonely Island are going to do a verse on it. Are you interested? And we were like, all right, send the song. So they sent the song. And it did sound like us. It was a really, you know, really basic demo. But I was like, oh, God, that kind of does sound like us. So they asked us if we would record a demo of it. We were on tour in Europe, and we sent a demo in, and they were clear. There were other bands that were submitting. So, you know, chances of us getting it was slim. And a couple weeks later, we heard back, and they said, you're perfect for this. And I flew to L.A. and went into the studio with Mark and did most of the vocals. And then Sarah went into a studio in New York and did all the backing vocals. And when the movie came out, I had no idea, obviously, that it was going to be so big. We were in New York City. Sarah was living there at the time. And we actually went and saw it with Sarah Bareilles. This is so random, but we were just like, she and Sarah were friends in New York. And she was like, hey, let's all go see the Lego movie together. And we went to the Lego movie. And I will never forget, like, I was in the movie being like, wow, they play the song a lot. Like, it feels like it's going to be probably really big. And it was huge. I also felt immediately like, I know it's really like parents have come up to us for like 5 years now being like, thanks a lot for writing that song, meaning like, oh God, we have to hear that song so much. But it was such a cool thing. It happened so fast. It was just like huge. It was everywhere. And I just felt so lucky that we got to be a part of it. And then obviously, you know, in January they called and said the song in the movie's been nominated and they want to put together this huge medley or like, you know, group of performers. Lonely Island are going to do it. Mark Mothersbaugh is going to do it. would you guys go and do it? I was so scared. I wanted to say no. I'm not a TV person. I'm very nervous doing even like, you know, just playing with reason we played on Colbert. And it's like, I find it terrifying to play television. And my management were like, yeah, it's not really like, we're not asking if you want to do it. We're telling you you're going to do it. I'm so nervous. But it was so cool. It was an incredible experience. It's still hard to process. It's like this weird thing that didn't even feel like it happened to us, you know, to be on stage in front of a billion people and perform that song. It was wild. It was really wild.
Well, you know, there's a quote from Sarah about it saying, you know, we want to be a serious musical band while also being humorous people. But this was so adorable. The movie looked great. The opportunity to work with Mark Mothersbaugh, Lonely Island. It was sort of a no-brainer. Turned out to be this really cool moment. We feel like it was a win-win. So one of the things that always comes up about your live shows is the banter between yourself and your sister, that humorous aspect. But you don't per se really incorporate humor into your music, right?
Yeah. It is this interesting thing about us. We write, I think, really emotional, intense, you know, often very like relationship heavy music and songs. Yes. And then you come see us live and it's just like a comedy show or something. And we've definitely tried to balance that over the years, but I think that's how we break the tension. And it certainly was a skill set that we learned really early on because it helped us to win over audiences when we were opening for people. Obviously we spent the first decade of our career opening from, you know, for everyone from Neil Young to the Black Keys and the Killers. And, you know, you win over these audiences by, you know, in my opinion, letting them in on who you are. And right. I think that there was something interesting about watching us banter on stage. And we realized really early on that that was a great way to get to know us. But it's hard. Actually, it just happened the other night on stage where I was making a joke and Sarah was like, you know, we're not a comedy band. Like on the mic, she said that and the audience burst out laughing. And I said, well, I don't know. We're pretty funny. And then the audience laughed even harder. And Sarah was like, I could tell she was really annoyed. But I don't know what to say. We are funny people. And when we're in front of an audience, there's kind of nothing I like more than I love hearing people sing our music and I love applause. Like, I won't deny that. But there's really nothing I love more than hearing people laugh. And even if it's at our expense.
I'm telling you, you got to get Sarah on board. I want the comedy record. I want that on the horizon somewhere. That's have to be the next thing.
Yeah.
The next thing.
Yeah,
but
maybe,
you know,
yeah.
You have to work on her.
I do think often about, like, you know, we get pushed all the time, like, hey, you should do a podcast. And we brainstormed all these ideas and met with all these companies. And it was all pretty serious, or like, interview other celebrities. And we were just like, oh, God, boring. But sometimes I'm like, God, I think you could just give Sarah and I each a mic and just, we have to do the show once a week and we just talk about shit. And I think we're funny.
There was something you guys had done. There was some event going on and you were like tweeting in real time watching it. And I saw, I'm not very present on Twitter at all. Or maybe you did it through Facebook, but you were some event and you guys were going back and forth commenting on it in real time. And it was hilarious.
It's funny because I think for Sarah and I, you know, we're you know, this is our 20th year playing music professionally. We started when we were so young and we started prior to social media and we had years to figure out who we were as people, but, you know, also as musicians to develop our brand and our identity and, you know, to create a really strong community of fans and, you know, we've been so lucky because there's so much strength in that community that our record label and the people who work with us, they've pretty much just let us, we've been off leash our whole career, basically, you know, and we have 100% creative control over everything. And a big thing that's a part of, I think, what we were able to build was also this like really positive, like voice or narrative for our project, you know, this idea that like you can come and be whoever you want to be and whoever you are is awesome. And we're going to come and create a safe space for you and you can come see our show and we're going to laugh and there's going to be a lot of emotion, but it's also going to be a really positive experience. And, you know, I feel lucky for all of these things. And I think sometimes when we try to, like right now, we're out touring this record and this book, and there's a lot of heavy topics. You know, we're talking about identity and sexuality and homophobia and misogyny and the early reviews of our work and, you know, our fear and the disconnect we felt as young people. And it's really heavy and it's really intense. And I think it's been interesting to watch how the audience responds to that because, you know, I have an instinct to try to make people laugh anyway and to sort of make light of some of these things. And there are times in the show where people laugh at moments that aren't funny, but I think it's the like discomfort and shock of hearing some of these things. And I don't know, like, I just love all of this. I love that we're able to do this. I love that we're able to challenge ourselves and our audience. And I love that humor is the backbone of all of that, you know, that we come together and there's this relief that comes from laughing and even when it's sad or it's hard. And, you know, I just feel so grateful that we're able to do that, you know?
Both you and your sister are active politically and you're socially engaged. Can you tell us about the Tegan and Sarah Foundation?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, like most public people, there's a point where you hit, you know, a certain level where it just feels like every day someone's hitting you up being like, hey, come to our event, or hey, donate a guitar. And, you know, and I think that's amazing. I think those of us in these positions should use our, you know, should use our power for good. And I guess it was about 4 years ago where we were about to launch a record called Love You to Death. We were coming off of, you know, a huge record, Heartthrob, and we were getting hit up constantly. And we just sat down and started brainstorming, like, how do we maximize our efforts? And we decided to come up with a foundation. And specifically, we were like, we should raise money for LGBTQ women and girls. There's really not a lot of organizations doing that, especially not ones led by, I'll use the word celebrity here reluctantly, but there were really no celebrity organizations, you know, run by LGBTQ women like us that felt like we wouldn't be stepping on too many toes. And, and so we launched the foundation, and specifically we try to raise funds for organizations that are centering women and girls. And, we focus on healthcare and economic justice and representation. And, you know, women and girls in our community are still underfunded and under-researched and underrepresented. And we felt like we could help in those areas. A lot of our work in the last few years has centered, you know, specific like causes and organizations that raise money for women and girls. So we write a lot of grants to other organizations that are smaller and grassroots and are regional. But we also have a huge initiative where we raise funds to send LGBTQ youth to queer-affirming summer camps. So we send LGBTQ youth to 20 summer camps across North America.
What are the ages of these kids? You say youth, but what's the age group from?
Age 12 to 18. Most of the camps are 14 to 18, but there are some summer camps that have kids as young as 12. And a lot of the camps are in rural communities. A lot of these kids have not had access to gay straight alliances at their school or other queer representation. A lot of the kids are meeting other queer youth for the first time ever. And the camps tend to have like a real focus on mentorship, leadership, self-esteem, creativity, and building community outside of the summer camp. The summer camp's a week, but you know, a lot of these kids need support after summer camp's over. So the summer camps are incredible. But we also raise funds for classrooms across the U.S. through Donors Choose. So, you know, teachers can apply for funding so that they can bring in LGBTQ positive representation, like whether it's books or films or speakers to come in. And then we also have a real focus on healthcare. So we created a website all through volunteers called Queer Health Access. And it's a resource site where you can go and get information about queer friendly doctors and other organizations that are queer friendly in the healthcare realm. And then we have hackathons once a year where we bring, you know, 70 or 80 technologists, all LGBTQ identified, to come together and sort of hack healthcare information. Again, there's just so little research done on women in the community, specifically queer identified women and trans women. And so we're starting to fund in that realm as well.
Wow. Well, the other track we can listen to right now off of Hey, I'm Just Like You is I Know I'm Not the Only One. And I was looking at the writing credits, and it looks like that's one that Alex Hope had a bigger hand in. So what was her involvement with that particular song? And was there any specific tipping point that birthed kind of that song's creation, any particular episode that you recall?
Yeah, so when we were writing the book and we found all this video footage, one of the videos, like Sarah and I, we constantly were filming each other and our friends. And it wasn't just random footage. Like, we were interviewing each other. I think Sarah and I were both really interested in filmmaking and documentaries when we were teenagers. And we talk a lot about identity and stereotypes and sexuality, which is pretty progressive and wild when I think about the fact that we were also closeted, but we were really interested in those topics. And there's one video in particular that really moved me, where it's just Sarah and I in our room, or in Sarah's room, and I'm filming her and she's filming me, and she has this secret girlfriend who's her best friend, and she's gone away to school in Montreal, and Sarah's written a song called I Know I'm Not the Only One, and she wants me to record it so she can send it to her best friend. And the song is literally about how this, you know, secret best friend girlfriend has gone away and has a boyfriend, and Sarah's heartbroken. And so Sarah's performing the song and then like literally wrapping it up, you know, to send to this person in Montreal. And I just found the whole thing heartbreaking and just beautiful. And I found the song really moving. And when we went into the studio to record, I really wanted to sing that one. I really wanted to make sure that one got on the record. And we ended up singing it almost like a duet, like Sarah sings one verse and I sing the other. And Alex really got involved because the song didn't have a bridge. And she was like, I really think that the song needs a bridge. So we ended up, like, you know, she wrote a bunch of chords for it, and then we worked on the melody and the lyrics together. So we don't do a ton of co-writing. Mostly Sarah and I bring finished songs in, but it was really exciting to be able to include Alex and work on that section together. I think we may have had a little bit of tequila before we wrote that bridge as well. I don't usually drink in the studio, but it was after five, and Alex was like, all right, it's tequila time. And so we sipped a bit of tequila and laid down the bridge vocal for that. So
excellent. Well, Tegan, thank you so much for speaking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, my pleasure. It was a delight. Thank you so much for the support.
Well, we're going to leave now with I Know I'm Not the Only One off of Hey, I'm Just Like You. It's Tegan and Sarah in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Dragging you down with backflips, you even care? Secret for me, something I can't share. I wonder if someday we'll just be a memory. If we go off the track, will you wait for me? I know I'm not the only one who needs you like I do.
I'm not the only one. That's Tegan and Sarah here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and that track is off the new album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. It's the ninth long player from the Canadian Twins. Thanks again to Tegan Quinn for speaking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations, and thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. Remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Next time around, my guest will be Mike Scott of the Waterboys, whose latest full length is out now and called Where the Action Is. That's your next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.